Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Has the accountability movement in Texas public schools actually made education any better? And are we getting what we pay for when we issue contracts to high-stakes testing companies? Most families with children in public schools are aware of the cost of testing on teacher and sometimes student morale. My guest today has also looked closely at the financial cost of testing, which has remained constant even as state funding to help kids who score poorly has been cut. Nate Blakesley is senior editor at Texas Monthly. His article, Crash Test, appears in the May issue of the magazine. Nate, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So how did we start down the high-stakes testing path in Texas that would ultimately set a model for the country with no child left behind?
Well, it's hard to believe now, but it's actually been about 20 years since Texas started doing high-stakes testing. It all started with a report from a state agency that was tasked with trying to improve failing public schools in Texas and also trying to close what became known as the achievement gap, which referred to the difference between how well Anglo kids and minority kids did in Texas schools. Eventually, a Dallas school board member named Sandy Kress, who was also an attorney, was asked by then-Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock to help create a new assessment system for Texas. And essentially what they came up with is, in broad outlines, what we're familiar with nationally today. Standardized tests would be used not so much to evaluate how well kids were doing, but to evaluate how well teachers and schools were doing. They came to be known as high-stakes tests because very high stakes were attached to them. Teachers could lose their jobs. Kids could transfer out of low-performing schools. Even administrators could lose their jobs.
And it seems like a lot of people who remembered testing from their own childhoods were not alarmed in the beginning and not that concerned because what they imagined would happen was far less than the amount of testing that kids are experiencing today.
I think that's right, and I think that's true for many legislators that got behind the effort at the time. I mean, it's important to remember that the problem that they were trying to address was quite real. Some schools in Texas were doing poorly, not all schools, of course, by all means, and the achievement gap was very real. But I think probably a number of people who were involved early on probably never suspected that the school year in Texas would revolve to the degree that it does now around these tests, that they would become so important, so crucial to everybody involved in the system that they would sort of usurp the normal curriculum that we were using in Texas schools.
So No Child Left Behind, NCLB, passed in 2002. All states are ordered to create standardized testing programs. And since that time, this is astonishing, testing has become a $1.7 billion for-profit industry in America.
That's right. The system went national because Governor Bush was such a big fan of it in Texas, and when he became president in 2001, that was his first big initiative, was No Child Left Behind, and it did mandate. It didn't tell you what kind of testing regime you must create, but it mandated that all state school systems must come up with one, and the testing market, as you might expect, grew astronomically. It's now at least a $1.7 billion industry, and that's just for the testing. There's also, of course, software to be sold to help track how well kids are doing. There's curriculum associated with the testing. It's become an enormous industry. And because No Child Left Behind requires states to provide tutoring to kids that are not doing well, the tutoring industry has become really enormous, too. It is said to be as big as $4 billion a year.
So initial NCLB goals called for U.S. states to reach 100% proficiency for all students in reading and in math by next year. How close are we to that?
Well, we're not close at all. I mean, there were people at the time that bill was passed that said there's really no need to set a time frame like that, and the one that you're setting is far too ambitious, but they did it anyway. Last year, I think the number was something like 48% of schools nationwide failed to meet the benchmarks. And essentially what's happened is that the U.S. Department of Education has been forced to grant waivers, acknowledging that they could sanction schools for failing to meet these benchmarks, but they're not going to because, as a practical matter, so many of them are failing to reach the benchmarks that it wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be in anyone's best interest, certainly not politically, to do something like that.
How are decisions made about what equals a passing score?
Well, that's an interesting thing that I didn't really fully realize until I started reporting this story. I mean, the whole idea behind using a standardized test is that you're supposed to inject some objectivity into this process of judging how well students and teachers and schools are doing. But really, standardized tests don't do that, or at least not in the way that we think that they would. And that's because after all the kids take the tests and the scores come in, it's up to essentially the Commissioner of Education in Austin to decide what the passing score is. And he has a great deal of pressure on him or her to set a passing rate that's politically palatable. In other words, for example, back when Governor Bush was running to become president back in 2000, you know, he had made a big part of his campaign based on how well education had improved in Texas. They called it the Texas Miracle. And that put a great deal of pressure on then-Commissioner Robert Scott to say that kids were doing well. I'm not saying that he necessarily changed cut rates to favor the governor, but there's no question he was under pressure to do that. And subsequent to that, there have been some embarrassing scandals. Mayor Bloomberg in New York City, who is also a big accountability advocate, had egg on his face after some alleged gains, alleged closing of the achievement gap was revealed to have essentially been just statistical fudging of statistics, moving cut rates, moving the bar essentially to make it easier for kids to pass the test.
Yeah, I was really surprised when I received an explanation of one of my daughter's scores that said, okay, this is what it means to fail, this is what it means to pass, and this is what it means to be advanced. And it was only the kids who came in as advanced that the sort of explanation didn't say might need extra help. And I thought, gosh, if you're passing, it shouldn't mean that you need extra help to continue doing well in that class.
That's interesting. The other thing that I've heard parents and teachers complaining about on those score reports is how little information they give you about how well your kid did, why your kid got the score that they got, what they need extra help on. When I was interviewing someone who was a testing opponent, she showed me score reports from other national standardized tests like the ACT, mm-hmm. which provides tests for younger kids as well. And the score reports were much more detailed. They told you, you know, your kid needs to work on reading comprehension. Your kid needs to do this, needs to do that. Whereas the score reports that you get from STAR here in Texas are very basic and often are delivered long after your kid has taken the test.
What did you find out, Nate, about the effect that 20 years of this high-stakes testing has had on external measures of student performance like the SAT and like the ACT?
Well, it wasn't anything that I found out. It's sort of common knowledge in Texas amongst, you know, everybody who's involved in education, whether you're protesting or anti-testing, that Texas hasn't really improved on some very key measures, one of which is SAT scores. SAT scores haven't improved in the state of Texas after we are now, the nation has been doing this for 10 years. Texas has been doing this for 20 years. And then there are other key benchmarks. Efforts are made to assess how many kids leave high school, what we call career or college ready. That number is said to be as low as 23%. Now, people who are opposed to testing will say, well, that proves that it doesn't work. People that believe in testing will say, well, it just means, and have said, it just means we don't have the right test. And more specifically, what they began arguing about 5 years ago was what that means is the tests that we give high school students are not rigorous enough. The ones that we're giving grade school kids might be okay, but the high school ones are not rigorous enough.
And now, between third and eighth grade, Texas students are subjected to 17 test periods between third grade and eighth grade.
Yes, you have to pass 17 tests. Third grade is when you start taking them. You have to pass reading and math tests in third, fifth, and eighth grade or risk being held back. That is something that actually has been reformed in recent years. It used to be the default was if you failed those in third, fifth, or eighth grade, you would be held back unless, you know, you had some extraordinary measures were taken. Now there's more discretion for teachers and administrators to decide whether or not to hold those kids back. But there's no question that the stakes are high even in grade school. But what's really changed and what really has given some energy to the backlash against testing is what we're doing in high school now,
where we have 15 end-of-course exams required to graduate from high school, regardless of performance in the classroom and grades.
That's right. It used to be four tests were required to graduate, and these four tests were fairly generic. They were, you know, sort of testing English language arts and math and social studies. And one of the things that teachers complained about was that those tests didn't match up very well with the curriculum that they were required to teach kids by the state of Texas. And so as a reform to sort of mollify teachers on that, they suggested switching to what they call end-of-course exams, which were supposed to very carefully track the curriculum in each course that you took, and were supposed to also count. They were supposed to be like a sort of a substitute final exam. They would count as a portion of your grade in the class. But what they did was they required kids to pass 15 of these in order to get out of high school, and that has really made Texas an outlier in terms of how we measure up with other states. No other state requires more than 9. 25 states require no exit-level exams at all, and most that do have them require 3 or 4.
We'll talk much more about this in just a minute with Nate Blakeslee. He's senior editor at Texas Monthly and author of the article Crash Test, which appears in the May issue of the magazine. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org. We are, of course, taking just a quick break here to remind you of the spring membership campaign that we are in the middle of right now. Looking this hour to have 25 contributions to the station. We have 17 left to go, 160 overall, in order to make our challenge grant for the day from the BNSF Foundation. That is an additional $5,000 from KERA. So if you are ready to make a contribution in any amount to KERA, today would be a really great day to do it, to be part of all of these people that come together and allow the station to receive an additional $5,000. Jeff Whittington is in studio now. He is executive producer of Think. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I want to thank Laura Jacoby and Richardson. Maybe it's Jacoby. Thanks so much, Laura. Vivian Tribble in Grapevine. Thanks also to Kristen Mead and Lucas Malo in Dallas and Catherine Garner in Dallas. We also heard from Marilyn Halpin in Dallas, Gail Sprinkle in Dallas, and Della Hollins in Dallas, and Rick Cook in Dallas. Lots of folks calling and joining online in Dallas, but they're not alone because Debbie Hurst in Grand Prairie has contributed. So has Ian Maxey in Fort Worth and Peggy and Mark Velasquez in Irving.
So nice of all of you. Wonderful to hear from everyone who loves the station, who makes contributions. We cannot urge you enough to try it. Become a member of KERA. See how great you feel and see listen to your money at work throughout the course of the next year. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org, where you can also check out a variety of different cool thank you gifts for the public radio lover that you are.
You know, both of today's Think shows are about education in one form or another, and we still have copies of our first hour guest, Kevin Smokler's book, Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. Of course, this hour we're diving into this standardized testing issue, which is a huge issue all over the country. It's a huge issue for our country's educational system, and we know it's an important issue to you. We know that whether or not you have kids, education affects us all, and it affects all of our futures. So that's why it's a subject that we cover with great regularity on Think. Show us that you appreciate that by supporting the station and supporting the show at 888-694-6931.
It's easy to make a tax-deductible contribution. It takes very little of your time to go online to kera.org or call 1-888-694-6931. We know that you are a passionate lifelong learner if you are a regular listener to KERA. This is the kind of content that you can only find here on the broadcast dial. So please support it with your dollars at kera.org or 888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Nate Blakeslee. He is senior editor at Texas Monthly and author of the article Crash Test, which appears in the May issue of the magazine. We're talking to Nate today as part of our American Graduate Initiative. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think at kera.org. You also spoke for this piece, Nate, to Diane Ravitch, and the education advocate, and she famously converted from a belief that schools might be better off run like businesses. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, she's an interesting case. She became involved in the accountability movement back in the 90s. She had an appointment in George H.W. Bush's Federal Education Department, and then she went to the Hoover Institute at Stanford, which is where a lot of sort of the deep thinking behind the accountability movement came from. And she told me, as she explains in her book, that she was at first quite taken with the accountability movement. You know, she thought that schools could benefit from maybe a little bit of a market sensibility, the idea that you ought to set goals and, you know, rewards should be doled out or punishments if those goals were not met. Over the years, though, she said she became somewhat disillusioned, and her background is that she is an educational historian. She's probably the best-known educational historian in the United States. And she had spent a lot of her career sort of chronicling these fads and trends that have moved through education over the years in the 19th and 20th centuries. And in time, she said, she came to think of the accountability movement as just another one of these fads, and a big idea that everybody latched on to that didn't have just a whole lot of research and evidence backing up the ideas that underlay it. And she came to think that over time it was doing more harm than good, and there was very little to suggest that it was doing what it set out to do.
And we do have evidence in multiple instances that tying bonuses to performance or tying the ability to be fired to performance on these tests is an incentive to cheat.
Yes, unfortunately there have been some really embarrassing and in some cases tragic cheating scandals. There's just sort of the generic take the tests into a dark room and erase the incorrect answers and put the correct ones in there. But there have been some that have been so systematic that dozens of people have been fired or even arrested, like the scandal in Atlanta. And then probably the saddest one and least well-known one is the one that's gone on out in El Paso.
Mm-hmm.
Out there, a superintendent was arrested for a contracting fraud, but federal investigators also discovered that he was perpetrating another type of fraud in conjunction with some principals, which involved essentially identifying kids that probably would not do well on the high school standardized tests and essentially driving them out of school or making it very difficult for them to re-enroll in school if they had already dropped out. And, you know, what's so sad about that is that the whole idea behind this high-stakes testing movement is that it was supposed to address the achievement gap. It was supposed to lower dropout rates. And here you have this individual and the people he conspired with actually encouraging people to drop out. And he's now doing federal time.
I read with interest the fact that although education funding was cut in the state recently, the amount of money we are spending on these standardized tests has not changed.
Yes, that's one of the things. If you had to go back, we are in the midst now of a truly enormous and statewide backlash against high-stakes testing. More than 80% of all the school boards in the state of Texas have signed resolutions saying that they are now opposed to high-stakes testing. Even some schools, and I'm sure you've seen them, they have those giant banners outside that say, we are a recognized school, we are an exemplary school. They have these different categories depending on how well you do on the test. They're taking their banners down in solidarity with the schools that don't have the banners, and they're saying, we're not going to play this game anymore. Mm-hmm. And if you had to go back and say the point at which sort of what broke the camel's back was, well, first it was the rollout of this new high-stakes testing program in high school that we discussed earlier, but also it was the budget cuts that came in 2011 to public education in Texas, truly unprecedented budget cuts. $5.4 billion was cut because of the shortfall caused by the recession that began in 2008, but also because it's clear now that Texas has sort of an ongoing disconnect between how much revenue it collects and how much it spends, but that's sort of a subject for another story. But they cut public education funding at the same time they were ratcheting up accountability. They were rolling out this new regime of STAR tests that began last spring. And normally, anytime they introduce a new testing regime, it's always more difficult than the previous one. And in recognition of that, they have always increased funding for things like tutors and special help for kids and extra teachers and that sort of thing. And this time, they did the opposite.
So lots of folks on the phone. I want to get to those in just a minute. But before we do, talk for a minute about the reason that suburban parents whose children have historically done pretty well on these exams, who were not in great danger of failing or being in failing schools, suddenly are really up in arms about the latest iteration of this, including the end of course exams.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked that, because that probably more than anything else is the reason we're going to see significant change from the legislature this year in how we do high-stakes testing. You know, the accountability movement really wasn't aimed at kids that were in high-performing schools, kids that were doing well already. It was aimed at addressing this problem schools and kids that weren't doing well. And, of course, all the kids in Texas had to take the tests, but it was really didn't really change life all that much in the high-performing districts and schools. You know, they took the exams. They were kind of a nuisance. There weren't very many of them, and they weren't considered particularly difficult in these schools. These schools, kids were more focused on taking AP tests so they could get college credit, on taking college entrance exams, of course, like the SAT or ACT. But now, with the new end-of-course exams, now that you have to pass 15 tests to get out of high school, now that the test counts for a portion of your grade, and a provision that I didn't mention earlier, if you don't score well enough on your English 3 or Algebra 2 exams, you can't get into the four-year institutions in Texas, public institutions. Now, all of a sudden, testing became more than just a nuisance in those higher-performing areas, those suburban schools. And now, all of a sudden, you had sort of middle-class suburban parents becoming much more interested, much more involved in what was going on with high-stakes testing and beginning to organize against it. And in Austin in 2011, a small group calling themselves Texans Advocating for Meaningful Student Assessment, TAMSA, began organizing first around just getting rid of that 15% rule that a portion of your grade would come from how well you did on this standardized test, but then expanding it to a much broader critique of high-stakes testing in general. And I wrote in my piece that they got an enormous boost when they got a woman named Susan Kellner, who was the head of the Spring Branch ISD. That's a West Houston suburban school district. She was the head of their board. Her husband, Larry Kellner, was a big political donor, a big Republican donor, and the former CEO of Continental Airlines. They both live in Senator Dan Patrick's district. Dan Patrick is the Republican chair of the Senate Education Committee. And so suddenly this group of concerned suburban moms became much more politically powerful.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll speak with Ed in Duncanville. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I'm sitting here. This is killing me. This really hurts. My quick question is, can we reform education at all if we rely on a test? And I got to tell you, my perspective is I staffed the Senate Labor Committee when the Excellence in Education report came out. I served in Ronald Reagan's Education Department under Bill Bennett in the Research Division with Chuck Finn. I know Diane Ravitch, and I have spent the last 6 years teaching in Texas, and it ain't working. We're getting great bubble guessers, and I can do that really well, but I am not rated on making kids college ready. I'm rated on whether or not I can get the one kid who passed the test perfectly last time to improve his perfect score.
What do you think, Nate?
Well, I'm happy that a teacher was the first person to call in, because obviously teachers know more about this issue than anybody, because they live with it every day. And, you know, if you talk to almost any teacher in Texas, will tell you that the way that the emphasis on high-stakes testing has dramatically changed their job, and that they didn't get into this profession, you know, in order to teach a kid to be able to pass a test. They got into the profession because they enjoy kids, watching kids learn and grow, and because they wanted to be able to create their, you know, their own curriculum And I think the caller will agree that probably one of the saddest side effects of this high-stakes testing revolution is that it has really changed the quality of instruction in classes for the kids and for the teachers.
When you describe, Nate, these rallies that many, many schools have to sort of pump kids up for the test and these mantras they're given to say, I have to tell you, it sounds to me like something you'd see in North Korea.
Well, I agree. I said in the story, and you know, I kind of struggled to keep this line in there because my editor thought it was a little bit much, but I said that, you know, there's a whole genre now of YouTube videos, which are these sort of youth training films inspiring kids to get ready, to gear up, to get pumped up to take this test upon which their entire future and the teacher's future and the school's future hinges. And I said after you watch a few of them and they're cute, you know, some of them are homemade, the third graders are singing, the teachers are singing. But then after you watch a dozen of them or so, it gets a little disturbing. Hmm. And I said in the story that you know, it's like you fell asleep in the first act of To Sir with Love, and you woke up in some kind of Maoist re-education camp. And the one that I singled out was actually, some of your listeners may have seen it, it was from the Mesquite ISD, and it was this professionally produced video which involved a series of shots of young kids, third graders, that just looked like the most depressed and stressed out kids you could imagine. And the title cards, you know, that the words that were going across the screen were just getting more and more dire until finally it shows this 8-year-old girl sort of poring over this test. The words on the screen come up, you know, somewhere, and a girl is taking the STAR test. She's worried. She's nervous. She's afraid she won't do well. What should she do? Study more. Everything depends on it. And like you say, it does have the feel of some kind of, you know, sort of badly translated Maoist training video.
Nate Blakeslee is with us. He's senior editor at Texas Monthly and author of the article Crash Test, which will appear in the May issue of the magazine. If you want to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. We'll talk more with Nate, more with you in just a couple of minutes. We do want to take time out to make sure that we are paying the bills here at KERA. And by we, I mean collectively all of us. Jeff Whittington and I, producer of Think, executive producer, we're members of the station. Lindsay Connect is a member. Just about everybody you hear on our air is a member. And that's because we believe in the product as much as you do. You can make your contribution now at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931. We were looking for 25 contributions during this hour of Think. We have 150 to go in order to make the BNSF challenge for the day. So your contribution now is really important. It will keep us on track, and it will also provide for you another great year of the radio station you tune to all the time.
Yeah, the BNSF Challenge is from the BNSF Foundation, and they have put up a $5,000 challenge to encourage you to make your contribution today. What we've got to do is hear from 350 listeners with a contribution in any amount at any time today. Right now is a great moment to call 888-694-6931 or to click and join at kera.org. Chris, we've heard from looks like about 206 people so far today, so 144 calls or online donations left to go in order to unlock this $5,000 additional gift that we could get from the BNSF Foundation.
Think fans have been helping us meet hourly goals. We so appreciate your engagement with the show as a listener, but especially as a supporter, because that, you know, with no dollars coming in, we couldn't produce a local show. Frankly, we couldn't bring you a national show if there was no support from listeners. So we want to thank people like Pamela Robinson in Lancaster, Jennifer and John Mosel in Dallas, Penny Jones in Richardson, and Sharon Kanani in Plano.
Yeah, the bills from NPR and PRI and American Public Media to bring you the nationally distributed programs that you hear on KERA are in excess of $1 million a year. And that's because this is the fifth media market in the country. So, you know, you live in a very big media market here in North Texas. And that's great because that means there are lots of you who have the opportunity to find and listen to and then ultimately hopefully support KERA. But it also means that sliding scale You know, the tiny little station in Alaska doesn't pay a whole lot to air Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And they'll probably play records or, you know, CDs, I guess, at this point, have volunteers come in and do that kind of thing most of the day. They probably have some local content as well. But they don't run the shows that we do, and they don't pay the bills that we do here in the fifth largest market in the country. Well, that's because it's big and that's how it works. And you know what? We've got to pay what NPR charges us in order to bring you just those shows, not to mention the shows that you hear and the reporting that's done here with our expanding newsroom and the program that you're listening to right now.
1-888-694-6931 is our telephone number. I always like to go online to kera.org. If you're interested in thank you gifts, we do still have copies of Practical Classics, the book we discussed with Kevin Smokler in the last hour. That's, you know, the 50 books you might not have touched since high school that you want to go revisit. That's available at the $10 a month level or $120 a year. But we have other thank you gifts as well. We have think mugs, we have tote bags, we have thumb drives, we have all kinds of fun stuff. If you've heard about something throughout the course of the drive and we're not talking about it right now, chances are you can still have it. If that's the thing that will make you make your contribution today for the year, please, by all means, get in touch and we will do whatever we can to hook you up with that item.
Yeah, just check it out. You can check most of that stuff out online at kera.org. Maybe you're listening online. Maybe you're listening to our podcast. Maybe you catch the show during the rebroadcast in the evening. Well, we're still available to take your call right now.
Always people available.
At 888-694-6931. And the web, unless, you know, there's been some sort of super meltdown because everybody tried to join all at once, which I'd love to see happen,
that
actually.
That would be great.
The web is still accepting your contribution at kera.org. Please do your part right now. Help us meet this BNSF challenge. It's a $5,000 at-risk challenge. We just got to hear from 140 more listeners. And, you know, at this moment right now, it's about 20 minutes till 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I think we can do this today, but it'd be great if we could do it sooner than later. It's all about wrapping up the drive as soon as possible.
1-888-694-6931 is our telephone number. You can also take care of this online at kera.org. Support the station that allows you to engage in a significant, substantive one-hour discussion on issues as important as high-stakes testing in America and in Texas specifically. Your contribution helps to pay for this kind of quality journalism in your community. Thanks for your support.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Texas Monthly senior editor Nate Blakeslee about his article Crash Test, which appears in the May issue of the magazine. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Nate, before we go back to the phones, I do want to talk about this. What about people who are supporters of ongoing testing who say, look, if you're teaching kids appropriately, if you are giving them the instruction they need, then they don't need all this drill and kill, and the only time spent on testing is the time spent literally sitting there filling in bubble sheets?
Well, that's the argument that Sandy Kress made in my story. Sandy's the person we mentioned in the first part of the story who essentially created the accountability system in Texas and then went to Washington with George W. Bush and helped create No Child Left Behind.
And now, excuse me for interrupting, now lobbies for the company, am I correct, that does the testing in Texas?
Yes, he's now a lobbyist for Pearson, which holds the testing contract in Texas and in many other places. What Sandy has argued essentially is that it's not his fault or the fault of Pearson or anyone else that testing has become such a big part of the school year in Texas. That, as you say, that if the curriculum is followed properly and the test is tailored to the curriculum, which they maintain that it is, that all you have to do really is just sit down and take the test. When you put that version or that argument to a teacher or administrator in Texas, you know, they throw up their hands. They're so frustrated by hearing that, because that does not match the reality that they live in. The idea that you can create a test which a single test on which hinges so much, not only in the kids' future, but also the teacher's career and the future of the school. And the idea that that test wouldn't become so outsized and so important and such a central part of the school year that more and more time and more energy and resources would become devoted to it, because that is what happens. It's not just the week that's spent on testing. It's also benchmark testing that's done throughout the year to make sure kids are making progress. They pull kids out of class, you know, gym or art or even other classes in the weeks leading up to the test. They do these endless worksheets, drill and kill is what they call it. They teach the kids to think like test makers. You know, if you're looking at a multiple choice test and you have no idea what the answer is, you know, try to find the one answer on there that you know is wrong, because a test maker will always put one obviously wrong one off. Cross that out and then guess. And that's what the caller earlier was alluding to. You know, he didn't get into this business to teach kids to think like and outsmart test takers, although that's a big part of what he does every year.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Kyle on the line in Denton. Hey, Kyle.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
So I am a teaching fellow up in Denton, and the classes that I teach are remedial classes for students who did not do well enough on the standardized test to be put into normal college classes. And this has always kind of bugged me, because here we are, we're taking their money. They don't get credit for these classes, and yet they're required to take them. And so what we're seeing is, you know, students that aren't performing well on the test, and yet they're still going on to college and then winding up having to pay even more money out of pocket to take classes in things that they should have learned in high school. I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on this, Nate, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think that the problem that he's identified is a very real one. You know, when you do surveys of, for example, I mentioned a statistic in my story, 40% of kids that go to community colleges need remedial classes when they arrive. So the problem is a very real one. Kids are graduating from high school without being able to do entry-level college work. They are graduating from high school without being able to read or write, you know, a memo when they get a job somewhere. The question is the solution that we've come up with, is the solution that we've built our education system around the last 20 years, this set of reforms we've come to call the accountability movement, which the main one is high-stakes testing, is that the answer, or is it time to move on and try something else? Have we spent 20 years on this? Have we spent long enough on this to establish that it isn't accomplishing what we set out to accomplish?
What about people who argue that rather than less testing or more money, what schools really need to fix all the problems that exist, or many of them, is simply more freedom to fire bad teachers?
Well, that is implicit, or in some cases explicit, in much of what you hear and read about the accountability movement. I mean, the idea was that you would use these tests to see how well teachers were doing, and the reason you needed to do that, it was argued, was because many teachers were not doing their jobs properly. Teachers were failing kids, and it was too difficult to get rid of them. And if we could simply replace the worst teachers, in fact, someone came to the legislature and testified. One of Diane Ravitch's old colleagues at the Hoover Institute came and testified that if we could just get rid of the worst 8% of Texas teachers, our school system would be as good as the one in Finland, which is often held up as, you know, the paragon of an excellent education system. The problem with that, applying that argument, which is very popular in accountability circles nationally, to Texas, is that it isn't difficult to get rid of a teacher in the state of Texas. In places like New York and Pennsylvania and Boston, there are very powerful teachers' unions. Some of your listeners may have seen that infamous New Yorker story called The Rubber Room, which was about how difficult it was to fire a teacher in the city of New York because of how powerful the union is and the protections in the law. It's not that way here. In Texas, it's illegal for teachers to bargain collectively or to go on strike. Most teachers in Texas have one-year contracts. It's expected that they'll be renewed every year, but they don't have to be. And if a district doesn't want to renew a teacher's contract, they can do so for any good cause. And that good cause is whatever is stipulated in the contract, and it can include poor test scores. So, and the other problem is that we already have high teacher turnover in Texas. So let's say you were able to identify the quote-unquote bad teachers and get rid of them. How do you find the good teachers to replace them? And how do you keep and retain those teachers? This is, we're at a point in history now where teacher morale is at the lowest that it's been in 25 years. That's according to this annual MetLife survey of teachers. The survey doesn't do a good job of explaining why that's the case, but if you talk to any teacher, they will tell you that a big part of it is high-stakes testing, too much emphasis on high-stakes testing.
So talk about what's before the legislature this session that might at least, at the very least, overturn the 15 end-of-course exam requirement.
There's been a bill filed, House Bill 5, by Jimmy Dunn Acock, a Republican from Killeen, who's the head of the House Public Education Committee, that would roll back the number of exit-level exams, those tests that high school kids have to take, from 15 all the way back to 5, restoring it essentially almost back to what it was before we had the STAR changes. That bill seems to be making good progress, seems to be on the way to the governor's desk. It also would repeal that provision that 15% of your grade is determined by how well you do on that end-of-course exam. That provision seems to be dead. It is always possible, though, that the governor will veto that. He has threatened to veto earlier efforts to roll back the accountability system in Texas, and it's unclear sort of where he is on that today.
What can we learn from Finland and other countries that seem to be having better educational outcomes than we are?
Well, I pointed out in the story that Finland was an odd choice for legislators and advocates for testing to seize on here in Texas, and they have. And that this idea that we could fire 8% of our teachers in Texas and become like Finland was, as I said, surfaced in testimony at the Texas legislature and then was repeated in an op-ed by the head of the Texas Association of Business, who's a big testing advocate. Finland, this as a country, and Finland's education system is nothing like Texas. Finland doesn't really have an accountability system. They don't even record grades until kids are something like 11 years old. They don't take standardized tests until after they get out of high school. What they do have in Finland is a truly professional teacher corps where advanced degrees are the norm, where salaries are relatively high, where turnover is quite low. And the other big difference between Finland and Texas is that Finland doesn't have nearly as many low-income students as we do. Finland has a child poverty rate of something like 5%. And in Texas, it's 26%. And if you look at the number of kids that are on free or reduced lunches, which means they're either officially poor or very close to it, it's over 50% of the kids in public schools in Texas. It has become fashionable once the accountability movement sort of came to the fore to refer to that as an excuse. Oh, well, they've been saying for years that they can't educate poor kids. This has just become a crutch or an excuse for bad teaching. But those problems that those kids face are quite real. Something like one in four kids who are officially poor in schools have a substantiated case of abuse or neglect. One in three of them spend time in an emergency room for otherwise preventable diseases. They're in homes where they have often one parent, or they have two parents that are working two jobs. They're spending very little time with their kids. You know, they're not being read to. They're not in a home where a parent has been to college and has a college degree. There is a very big difference between how kids from poor households and how kids from middle class or upper class households, how they start out in school when they're 5 years old and they get to kindergarten. Those kids are already far behind the other kids.
Nate Blakeslee is senior editor at Texas Monthly. His article Crash Test appears in the May issue of the magazine. Nate, really interesting stuff. Thank you so much for joining us.
I was happy to do it. Thank you.
Thank you all for listening today. Really appreciate it. We especially appreciate those of you who are bringing us ever closer to achieving the challenge grant offered by the BNSF Foundation. $5,000 if we have a total of 350 contributions today in any amount, 126 to go in order to make this a reality. You can get us that much closer today by making your call to 1-888-694-6931 or going to kera.org. We know how much you care about education. It's the reason that we have done the American Graduate Initiative and other projects covering education. We've got a great new emphasis on local education coverage in our newsroom here. We know this matters to you. There's no question that your dollars have allowed us to add additional education coverage. So your support right now is a vote not only in support of the whole station of Think, but also of education coverage.
888-694-6931 is the telephone number to call. Or you can contribute online at kera.org. Absolutely, Chris Boyd, when we sit in our news meetings, we talk a lot about education coverage. We've hired a new full-time education reporter and blogger. Bill Zeeble is about to kick off, or already has really kicked off, a class of 2017 coverage initiative that's going to follow a group of eighth graders all the way through high school. Chris, you and I are working on an American Graduate project about what it takes to finish high school. And we're going to have a television program produced over the summer that's going to talk to high school students who met the challenge and a few that are still working on it. So this is a big deal to all of you. It's a big deal to all of us, really. And that's why it's so important that you support the station. I want to thank Charledine Newell in Denton and Helen Bruant in Dallas and Scott and Nancy Smith in Flower Mound. Also, I want to thank Paul Johnson in Irving and Chris and Jess Cole in Fort Worth and Philip Taylor and Hetty Helsel in Dallas.
They've all gone online to make a contribution at kera.org, or perhaps they've called in to 1-888-694-6931, and they've joined good folks like Harold and Jill Ellams in Cedar Hill, Robert Disbaum in Round Rock. Great to hear from Round Rock. Susan Levitt in Dallas, Ellen Osborne in Dallas, Libby and Jeff Nicodemus in Dallas, Brian Long in Dallas, Carol and Eric Bruno in Aledo, and William and Mary Morton in Little Rock, Arkansas. Thank you so much.
It is your public radio station. Obviously, there are a couple of folks listening in Round Rock there and Little Rock who tune to KERA for one reason or another. We know that lots of you listen all over the world to KERA. KERA is, when I'm out of town, I listen to other public radio stations. I also tune into other public radio stations on the internet to find out, you know, what they're doing. And I think we've got something pretty great here at KERA. And even if I didn't work here, I would say that because you know how the station sounds and you know why you keep coming back. And that's why we've made great progress today as well on this BNSF Foundation Challenge. It's $5,000. It's at risk. We've got to hear from 350 contributors today in order to unlock this $5,000 additional gift to KERA. Chris, we got about 125 donations left to go to make that goal. You know, when we started the Think Show at noon, we had about 200 left to go. So we've heard from about 75 or so of you. Thank you so much. But please take this opportunity, if you have not yet given during this spring membership campaign, if you can see clear and can handle making an additional gift right now to help us push us over the edge here and get this extra $5,000 in the door, that'd be great.
We know that we have a lot of loyal podcast listeners to this show in particular from this area, but also from the broader United States and even around the world. I would argue that even if the only thing you listen to on this station is Think, if this is something that is part of your sort of regular week and you always want to see what we have on offer, that's worth a few dollars. That's worth a quick contribution at kera.org. If you're in the U.S., you can easily call 1-888-694-6931 as well. Even if you have time shifted and you're listening to this days after we've talked about it, we always have folks available at the phone lines. And of course, you can always make a contribution online to kera.org. So podcast listeners, please consider this and make just chip in a few dollars, if this is the only thing you listen to on KERA.
It is a highly listened to and downloaded podcast that we produce that our colleague Christine McConnell edits and posts every day for us. And, you know, that's a reason to give. That's a service that you get from this station. And if you haven't supported KERA, then you're using that service for free. We'd ask that you choose to support it with a contribution of some dollars. It would be great at any amount, really any gift of support right now would go a long way on this challenge. The number to call, 888-694-6931, or do it online at kera.org.
125 contributions left to go to make the $5,000 BNSF Foundation. You can make yours now in any amount at kera.org or by calling in to 1-888-694-6931. So happy to have you with us, and we really, really appreciate your support. Thank you so much.